Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is the second hour of the program. We're live this morning coming to you from our studios here at WILL. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about North Korea and the continuing international tensions and concerns about North Korea and that country's intent to produce nuclear weapons. There has been tension particularly between the United States and North Korea now going back at least to the year 2002. That was the year when President Bush said that North Korea was part of an axis of evil along with Iraq and Iran. It was also that same year, a few months later, that it was revealed that North Korea did indeed have a secret nuclear weapons program. In the January of the next year, 2003, North Korea withdrew from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Also that same year, talks began involving six parties in an effort to try to persuade North Korea to abandon its nuclear ambitions. There have been a number of rounds of these talks. The most recent, the fourth round of talks, took place last September 2005, and it seemed that for a moment there might be an agreement. That didn't last very long, and an attempt to revive the talks as recently as last month was not successful. We'll be talking this morning with someone who has followed events in Korea and elsewhere in East Asia for some time. His name is Gordon Chang. He's lived and worked in China and Hong Kong for nearly two decades. He's written for a number of different publications, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Far Eastern Economic Review, and the South China Morning Post. He has also lectured often at universities and other institutions in this country and abroad. He's the author of a recently published book. It came out just at the beginning of the year, a book titled Nuclear Showdown: North Korea Takes on the World. It's published by Random House, also author of a previous book entitled The Coming Collapse of China. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Chang, hello.
How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks, and thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Let me ask you a very basic question to start. Does North Korea pose a threat to the United States, or perhaps more important, to its immediate neighbors?
North Korea certainly poses a threat to its immediate neighbors because of its nuclear weapons and because of its short and intermediate range missiles. But North Korea poses a threat to the United States and the rest of the world because, by its defiance, it is taking down the world's arms control regime. And so we're not just talking about North Korea. We're talking about Iran, Syria, Algeria, and every other nation that wants the most destructive weapon in history. So, in effect, North Korea affects and threatens all of us.
It seems that what I'm certain frustrates many people in thinking about the problem of North Korea and its nuclear ambitions is that it seems that we have so few options here. It seems that we have so little in the way of possibility of persuading the government of North Korea to take a different path.
Well, that appears that way because we've been so unsuccessful with regard to North Korea's nuclear program. We've been talking with the North Koreans since January 1992, and the international community has been dealing with North Korea on its nuclear program since the late 1980s. And yet North Korea has been able to nuclearize itself, to develop weapons, and certainly to increase the range of its missiles. The United States has probably been so ineffective largely because we have been adopting policies that are inconsistent with one another and which generally I think are ill-conceived. So I think it's really, when we look back at it, it's no wonder that we're failing miserably when it comes to North Korea.
Well, I'll just go right to the question of, you know, let us suppose that we could make you the Secretary of State and you could be in a position of crafting the policy of the United States toward North Korea. What do you think that we should be doing?
Well, in order to craft a policy towards North Korea, I'd need to be more than just the Secretary of State. I probably would also need to be the Secretary of Defense and the head of the National Security Advisor, because the United States right now has many different policies towards North Korea. So, in effect, we've got none. But I think one of the things that we need to do, at least the most immediate thing, is to try to peel away South Korea from China. Both of them have been supporting North Korea. And because South Korea wants to do that, China has been given sort of free rein to be irresponsible. If we can convince South Korea to adopt policies that are more consistent with ours, then China would have to stand alone in its support of North Korea. And I don't think that it would want to support Kim Jong-il, the leader of that country, because to do so would antagonize the United States. So the first thing we need to do is peel away South Korea from China.
You would, well, let's perhaps talk a little bit about the policy of the South, of South Korea toward the North. You would think that of all of the people here in the world and in the region who would feel, who could feel threatened by North Korea, it would be South Korea. What exactly is the interest of, or what is the policy of the South in regards to the North?
Well, the South, for the last few years, has been fully supportive of North Korea, trying to keep that government in place and trying to reduce tensions, which in general is not a bad idea, to try to reduce the level of anxiety on the Korean Peninsula. But by doing so, it's permitted North Korea to very much engage in policies that, as I mentioned before, threaten all of us. And the reasons why the South Koreans are doing that are many and varied. Part of it is just Korean nationalism. But I think also that the South Koreans correctly analyze that they are not really threatened by North Korea's nuclear weapons, because the North Koreans could destroy South Korea anyway with conventional weapons or with chemical and biological weapons. So you can only die once. And so I think to a certain extent the South Koreans see that the nuclear weapons program does not really pose an additional threat to them. Also, I think that the South Koreans are very afraid of the North, and so therefore are trying, in a very real sense, to appease Kim Jong-il. And so, therefore, they've got a policy which is very much at odds with our policy and with the policy of the West.
It would seem that that they and perhaps others have adopted this policy that says, as bad, as problematic as the government of North Korea is, it's better to have that than to have whatever kind of instability would result if that government wasn't there. It seems to be the sort of the classic case of the devil you know being better than the one that you don't. Is that in fact the case?
That's exactly the case. For a long time, South Korea's leaders tried to destabilize the North. And then when West Germany absorbed East Germany, the Koreans realized how expensive that was. For Korea, the burden would be much more, because South Korea is not as big in relation to North Korea as West Germany was to East Germany. And, of course, the North Koreans are poorer than the East Germans were. So all of a sudden, really in the beginning of the 90s, the South Koreans realized that they did not want to take over the North, at least not then. And so they radically shifted their policies over the period of about 3 or 4 years, so that instead of trying to oppose the North, they end up now supporting it.
You, I think, make the argument that that there perhaps is only one nation that really has any leverage, has any possibility of persuading the government of North Korea to do anything differently, and that is China. We have not been particularly successful in getting the Chinese on board with anything that we would want to implement. And what's the Chinese policy toward the North?
Well, China has been consistently supporting North Korea since the very beginning. North Korea would have lost the Korean War were it not for Chinese intervention on the side of the North. And since that time, in various ways, Beijing has supported Pyongyang, and it's doing so today. This is a consistent foreign policy that goes back decades. And for the Bush administration to think that Beijing would destabilize North Korea, or at least to take away North Korea's most important military weapons is a little short of naive.
Where, I guess I'm still at the point of thinking where it is that we can go now. I mean, given all of this, I mean, given the fact that it's difficult to get other nations to cooperate or at least to get everybody on the same page, given the high level of intransigence of the North Korean government, that just it doesn't seem to offer the United States or the rest of the international community much of any place to go with this.
Well, short of military means, that certainly appears to be the case. But there's a lot that the United States can do to peacefully disarm North Korea. And part of it is, if you look at the long-term strategic objectives, I think the United States needs to get the cooperation of both its foes and its friends to disarm North Korea. Because if all of North Korea's neighbors, and indeed if all the world told Kim Jong-il that he had to disarm, he'd have no choice but to do so. So the United States needs to obtain cooperation. And the one reason I think why we haven't been able to obtain cooperation is because we have a nuclear weapons doctrine that is sometimes hostile and certainly not very attractive to the rest of the world. And one of the things that we could do, and it would have virtually no cost for the United States, would be to substantially reduce our own weapons because we have many more than we need. We have weapons for which there are no delivery systems. We have more than about 10,000 warheads, and that's about 9,999 more than we need. So in a sense, I think that the United States could substantially reduce the arsenal, try to obtain cooperation from other nations, and therefore really have no cost for us because we don't need that many warheads to deter our adversaries.
Let me again introduce our guest, Gordon Chang. He's a journalist. He's lived and worked in China and Hong Kong for almost 20 years, has written for a number of different publications, has authored a book about China that was out recently entitled The Coming Collapse of China. We talked about that, in fact, here on the program. His new book is about North Korea, and it's titled Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. It's published by Random House. It came out at the beginning of the year. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Certainly, there has been a lot of belligerent rhetoric coming out of Pyongyang from the government of North Korea. But there also has been some fairly belligerent rhetoric coming out of Washington, D.C., going the other way. And I think that some people make the argument that that doesn't help, part of the motivation for having the nuclear arsenal is that the government of North Korea feels genuinely threatened now by the United States. Now, it might be that that's not reasonable, but that is indeed the way that they feel. Has the government of the United States made things worse by using the kind of language we have to talk about the country and its leadership?
Well, we certainly have made the situation worse. The United States can solve this problem by either being very peaceful or by being very belligerent. But the one way we cannot solve it is by being alternately belligerent and peaceful, and therefore having no policy at all. And that's effectively what we have been for the last five decades. So what we do is we undercut our long-term strategic goals by being belligerent if we're not going to be belligerent consistently. And so, you know, when you look back at North Korea, they have a nuclear weapons program not because of the United States. They originally wanted one because they're a militaristic state. And when the United States posed no threat to them after the Korean War, they still started to develop their own nuclear arsenal. But it is also true, as you point out, that today we have made the situation much more difficult to solve with language and rhetoric that the North Korean leaders find inherently threatening. So, in effect, what we have done is we have made it much more difficult to obtain a peaceful solution. We also, at the same time, are not willing to employ a military solution, which means that there is no solution at all. And time works against us because as time progresses, North Korea develops a bigger nuclear arsenal and certainly a more capable missile systems, which means that in a few years, probably between 5 and 7, North Korea will be able to hit any place in the United States with a nuclear weapon. And that's something that we have to take into account because we do need a solution now.
Mm-hmm. What, going back to last September, where there was this, it looked at least for a moment like there might be an agreement here. What happened? Were people being overly optimistic about the possibility of the agreement, or was there indeed, did things look good, and then something happened to scuttle that?
Well, I think that it's probably all of the above. Six parties at the six-party talks were able to hammer out this statement of principles, which included the denuclearization of North Korea. But in effect, that statement, if you look at it, is inherently flawed because although it had this general principle about North Korea disarming, it had nothing about the practical steps necessary for that goal and had virtually nothing about verification, which is absolutely critical. The day after the statement was released, all six parties gave their own versions of what the statement meant, and all six versions were very, very different. And in addition, the second day after the statement was issued, North Korea started talking about nuclear war with the United States. So clearly, there really was no agreement to speak of. And anyone who thought that this was going to be a roadmap for a solution, I think, was really being misguided. North Korea at that point was not willing to solve the issue, and neither was the United States in a sense. So I think that when we look back at it, this really was not an opportunity lost. There really was no opportunity to start out with.
We have some callers to talk with. Let's do that, starting with someone listening this morning in Indiana. Line 4. Hello.
Hello. Two questions. One, you were talking about the naivete of the Bush administration. I guess I'd have to agree with you on that. What bothers me about it is I can't understand it. You know, you'd think there's somebody, you know, I just can't imagine they're that ideologuish, I guess, is the way to look at it. And it really puzzles me, looking over the history, there's been a lot of that anyway with state departments and other people. But I was wondering about the mishmash with the defense people do their thing, then the State Department does their thing and stuff like that. How far down does that, you know, disrupt things? And the second question is maybe more speculative. Is there anything out there or something, or not this, put it this way, what would have to occur for us to put a wedge between China and North Korea so China would, you know, start pulling the strings a little more tauter and satisfy us? We're so hooked into them economically, you know, I can't see anything, but I don't know enough about it. I thought maybe, you come across some ideas where that might go. Thanks.
I guess with regard to the first question, Bush administration policies are many and varied, and there have been many different approaches tried. None of them have been really allowed to go to fruition, and so we've really had very little policy at all. And what we have had are various parts of the government at war with each other in terms over North Korean policy. The one thing President Bush has not done, which he needs to do, is to step in and say, this is the policy and this is the approach of the United States and this is the way we're going to solve it. Because we're so much more powerful than North Korea, we should be able to solve it, and we can do it if we have consistency of approach and if we are resolute. With regard to your second question about what can the United States do to drive a wedge between China and North Korea, I think the United States very clearly needs to tell China that this is an important matter to the United States. North Korea poses an existential threat to world security, and you're either going to be helpful or not. And if you're not going to be helpful, there is very little that we would not be willing to do, short of the threat of the use of force, to get China to do the right thing. As I mentioned earlier, I think one of the things we can do is, first of all, peel away China from South Korea. And that puts China in a very difficult position because then they have to take a clear stand. They either have to choose with their future, which is the United States, or they've got to side with their past, which is North Korea. And I think that in those circumstances, China would make the right choice. But we have never forced China to make that right choice, and that is our failing, not China's.
All right, let's talk with another caller here. Urbana is next, line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to know how you think we could peel away South Korea from its present policies and what your back background is with the coming collapse of China, what your reasons are for that thinking, and how that relates to these other problems.
Wow. I need a half an hour for the second question, so I think I'll start with the first one. Right now, the South Korean electorate is almost evenly divided between the progressives and the conservatives. And the progressives have these policies which are inconsistent with our own. I think one of the things the United States can do, you know, we always keep on saying, and I think it is absolutely true, that there really is no set of circumstances under which North Korea would want to give up its nuclear weapons program. Well, if that is indeed the case, then the United States should make very attractive proposals to solve the North Korean crisis, because we know that Pyongyang will just turn them down anyway. The benefit of that is that it would, our being and taking a soft position on North Korea in terms of trying to negotiate a peaceful solution would delegitimize the so-called progressive forces in South Korea. That would lead to the election of a conservative in December 2007, when the South Korean presidency is at stake. In those elections right now, South Korea has a progressive president, but he's extremely unpopular. His approval rating is just above 10%, so he makes President Bush look popular in comparison. And his ruling party has not won a by-election in more than a year. So the conservatives can actually win next time, and if the conservatives do win, it means that they will probably adopt policies that are more consistent with Washington's. And that means we can peel away South Korea from China. But to do that, I think we need to adopt a negotiating stance in the six-party talks that would be more conciliatory and certainly would be more attractive to the South Korean population.
Well, how could we do that? I mean, what would be the main elements of such a position?
Well, I think that what we could do is offer a broad package of inducements to North Korea, which would essentially be they give up their nuclear weapons program, they permit the strictest verification system that has ever been devised, because that's absolutely necessary. And if North Korea were willing to do that, then the United States would be willing to consider and deliver substantial assistance to the North Korean regime and to the people of North Korea, as well as diplomatic recognition, support for North Korea, trying to engage North Korea and move it to a much better place. That's controversial in a number of respects, but what it would do, I think, is it would make it very clear that the obstacle to a solution is not the United States, as many people in South Korea say, but that the obstacle to a solution is indeed North Korea and its complete insistence on maintaining its nuclear weapons. And if that, then, you know, I think the South Korean population will look at that and say, no, you know, the progressive plan isn't working, the United States is conciliatory and is trying to solve it, and that the reason that it's not being solved is because of North Korea, not the United States.
Well, I've been in South Korea, and I found an attitude there about wanting to reconcile and rejoin the whole Korean Peninsula, which is a view that many people have. And I don't see how that could work with a policy that would be supportive to the present regime in North Korea.
Well, essentially, you've got people in South Korea who want to support the North Korean regime and keep it going. And you've got the conservatives who are much more wary of North Korea. There is, in general, a desire among all Koreans, conservative or progressive, about someday having a united Korean nation. That's extremely popular, of course, as you can imagine. But nonetheless, there is about 50% of the population, and it's a growing part of the population because there is a growing New Right movement, that wants to be more supportive of the United States and is much more concerned about the threat posed by North Korea. Many people in South Korea are not concerned by the threat, and they vote progressive. Many people, however, are indeed very concerned about what's happening in North Korea, and therefore would be willing to help the United States. Now, if the United States had policies which were more attractive then I think that that would help the conservatives, the Grand National Party, which actually has a candidate that can win in December 2007. I mean, this is not guaranteed by any means. And Korean politics can be very volatile. But nonetheless, there is the elements of a solution that we could put in place. In fact, though, we can't be doing any worse than we're doing now, given the way we have approached the problem and alienated a good part of the South Korean population. So doing something new at least has the possibility of success. Continuing the way we're going is just a lose-lose proposition.
Yes, I understand. I take it that you do not think, then, that we should do what we did in Syria, bomb a nuclear facility.
We never bombed a Syrian nuclear facility. The Israelis in
the Israelis
bombed an Iraqi the Osirik nuclear reactor. And yes, I agree with that proposition. We shouldn't do that until we have exhausted every peaceful solution possible. And we haven't even started pursuing peaceful solutions in the way that we should. So, yes, I think that military solutions, although we can't take them off the table, as the phrase goes, I think that they are very, very much in the, you know, shouldn't be considered at this time, because there are so many other ways that we can solve this. Because we are, after all, the world's sole superpower. We do have a lot of leverage over not only South Korea and North Korea and China and Japan and Russia, the other countries at the six-party talks, but we're just generally a powerful nation, and we can do things if we're united and if we're resolute. Unfortunately, we have not been resolute when it comes to North Korea.
Yes, I understand, and that is necessary, I agree. Well, what about this view of China as facing a coming collapse? Would you elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah, I don't think that the Communist Party of China will be ruling the country at the end of this decade, because although China has become more prosperous, it's also become less stable. We've seen protests which are larger, more frequent, and
yes,
certainly more violent, and we've also seen protests on the part of the middle class, which has been the great winner of 25 years of economic reform. Essentially, what you have in China is another dynamic society, where you have a growing gap between the people and their government, because essentially what you have is enormous social change, which is the result of not only social engineering, but also more than 25 years of substantial economic reform. And at the same time, the government has remained intransigent politically. It still has retained a Leninist system. Although it may look very strong from the outside, nonetheless, no government can withstand this process of modernization, which really is the enemy of one-party states. We've seen modernization in South Korea, Taiwan, and Thailand change authoritarian governments. And this is something which we have seen for the last couple hundred years, starting with the French Revolution, which also happened in a period of prosperity. So essentially what we have got is an unsustainable system in a very volatile and dynamic country. And because of that, I don't see that the Communist Party can maintain its monopoly on political power indefinitely. It just doesn't make sense. No political party has been able to do that. And I don't think that the Chinese Communist Party will be the first in history.
Thank you for your views and information.
Thank you for the call. We're a little bit past the midpoint here. We have other calls we'll get right to. I just want to quickly introduce again our guest, Gordon Chang. He's a journalist. He's lived and worked in China and Hong Kong for nearly two decades. He's written for many publications, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Far Eastern Economic Review, the South China Morning Post. He has lectured often at universities and other institutions. He is the author of the book that we have talked about a little bit, The Coming Collapse of China. That book was published in 2001, and then a book that just came out at the beginning of this year titled Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, published by Random House. And it's out now. Certainly should be in the bookstores if you want to read it. Questions are welcome here on the show, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's someone on a cell phone. We'll get them next. Line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My thing is, these people in North Korean government that want to help their country and are willing to at least postpone nuclear proliferation, and I'm curious how far down the chain we'd have to cut the head off to, you know, put them in place.
That's a very interesting question, and it's something that people in Washington would dearly love to know the answer. It's clear, as you point out, that there are many people in the North Korean government who disagree with the current militarization of the country, and certainly who do not think that nuclearization and nuclear weapons arsenal furthers the security of North Korea. There are many people who are opponents of the regime, even in the regime itself. But the major component of the government, and it's a very narrow government, perhaps only 300 or 400 people make a difference, the major component of that is the military. And most people in the military, from what we can tell, support the maintenance and the further development of North Korea's nuclear weapons. Certainly Kim Jong-il, the supreme leader, does. But what we have is a divided government because after at least a couple decades of very poor economic performance and 3 or 4 years of famine, there are many people in the country who do not think that the country's current course is the right one. And so the United States could, if it wanted to, engage certain elements of the regime and, of course, the North Korean people and sort of woo them away from Kim Jong-il. Now, this is, if we went down this path, it would be certainly a long-term strategy, one that would take decades to implement. And so, therefore, it's not really a solution by itself to the North Korean problem. But nonetheless, it is something that could be used in conjunction with other techniques to denuclearize North Korea.
Yeah, that's what I would do is I would implement a humanitarian thing to the people because all those soldiers that you're talking about, they got families over there, and you start feeding their families and, you know, and then you cut off the head simultaneously. I'm thinking at least you're going to put some stability there for a little while anyway.
The United States, I should point out, is one of the largest donors of food to North Korea over the last 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
The United States has sharply reduced and even ended some humanitarian aid because the North Koreans do not permit verification. In other words, the United States will donate food, but we want to make sure that it ends up in the hands of the neediest North Koreans. And there has been diversion of food aid to the military and to elements in society that are favored by the regime. And so, therefore, because North Korea does not permit monitoring, we have cut off food aid. But in general, I think the United States can achieve many of its goals through a long-term program of providing food and medical assistance to the North. And one person had a very innovative solution, which was just to pile up the food aid at Panmunjom, which is at the demilitarized zone on the border between South Korea and North Korea, and tell the North Koreans they can have all the food they want just as long as they permit monitoring of it. And in a sense, I think that could be, it's a right approach in terms of developing a long-term relationship with the North Korean people.
Yeah, that's half of my scenario, but you got to implement the other half with it, I think. But anyway, thank you for your time.
All right, well, thanks for the call. Let's go to line 3. This is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Yes, I believe that China will fail in significant areas of capitalism because they have a totalitarianism, conformist, homogenous society that breeds cookie-cutter conformist citizens, yet they need the entrepreneurship so necessary in free markets and capitalism. Would you have any reaction to the contradiction of a conformist society needing the entrepreneurship of capitalism?
Well, I think that there certainly is that contradiction that you point out. In order for China to further develop its economy, it's going to need more reform and substantial reform. And I don't think that that's the type of reform that the government and the Communist Party are willing to undertake. Because to have this reform, to have a modern society and a modern economy, you need to have the rule of law. To have the rule of law, you need to have institutional curbs on government. Now, institutional curbs are incompatible with the founding ideology of the Communist Party, which is that they rule. And so, therefore, I don't think that they can continue reform of the economy for very much longer. They have actually slowed down reform in the last 3 or 4 years, with the exception of joining the World Trade Organization. But essentially what's happening right now is there is stagnation because the party does not have a consensus to move forward with structural reform. And so, therefore, this is a contradiction. The contradiction you specifically referred to, which was innovation, is also something which I agree does exist. You cannot have an innovative society, which means you can't have a vibrant economy if you have this political censorship that we see in China today. Because you just can't say to people, well, you know, you can innovate on this particular doohickey over here, but we won't let you talk about politics or anything else of interest. And it just doesn't make sense. So essentially, at the end of the day, you cannot have a modern society and have a one-party dictatorial Leninist state. It just doesn't make sense. No one-party state has been ever able to manage that, and they have all failed, which is to say that China has got to do something different than all of the others, and unfortunately, it's not. It's still the Communist Party insists on its monopoly on political power, and that leads it to do things which are just inconsistent with a modern society.
Their society certainly wouldn't have permitted a couple of bicycle shop owners to try and build an airplane or take a few months off while they stayed in Kitty Hawk.
No, exactly right. The Chinese are very entrepreneurial, as we've seen. I mean, they were very entrepreneurial before the Communist Revolution in 1949. And today, when the country has opened up a little bit, we have seen entrepreneurial activity. But nonetheless, we haven't seen innovation, and we haven't seen those breakthroughs of people going into a garage and developing Hewlett-Packard or Microsoft, or your example of being able to develop an airplane. And I don't think China will be able to do that in the foreseeable future, just because it has not willing to lay the groundwork for people to go out and do what they want to do. And that's really crucial to the development of a modern economy. They just are not going to be able to do it. And that's why they permit piracy, because they realize they are not going to be able to develop much technology on their own. So the best strategy for them is to steal it. And that's the reason why we're not seeing very much progress on their efforts to stop the piracy of intellectual property.
Thank you.
All right, let's go on to another caller. This is also Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm wondering, do you think there's really any reason that the North Koreans are going to be willing to settle as long as the Bush administration is in office?
Well, there have been reports, and I think that they are credible, that the North Korean leadership is really trying to delay until the 2008 election, because they see that the Bush administration is not going to come up with anything that is attractive to them. This is sort of the same thing that they did in the run-up to the 2004 election, where they were privately, and perhaps not so privately, rooting for the Democratic nominee, John Kerry. And so I think that they see that Bush administration has been weakened, and therefore they probably can wait it out, which is the reason why we're seeing the stalling tactics on the part of North Korea. So I agree with you that they pretty much have figured out that they can sort of slide by for the next couple of years.
It would almost seem to me they have to be mad to give up their nuclear deterrent. The only trump card they hold, given Bush's behavior in the past, that I can't see how they would ever reasonably suppose they could trust him.
Well,
there
I agree. Yeah, I agree with you there, but we got to remember that the origins of the North Korean nuclear problem were not in 2002. North Korea has been trying to develop a bomb since at least the early 1980s, and probably going back to the mid-1960s. And in the 1960s, the United States posed no threat at all to North Korea. As we know, the In the 60s, people were talking about the United States disengaging from Asia, and certainly there was no of this hostility that we see today. But nonetheless, you are correct in the sense that the North Koreans are not going to give up the bomb, at least peacefully, as long as there is a extremely hostile attitude towards them in Washington. It just doesn't make sense. There may be no peaceful solution short of what I talked about earlier in the program, which was a change in American nuclear weapons doctrine. But nonetheless, I think we ought to try.
It seems to me we need a doctrine in which we not only try to reduce the number of weapons outside our country, but also reduce our own. The situation with Iran, for instance, ignores the fact that there are four nuclear powers, none of them particularly reliable, surrounding Iran.
Well, I agree with you. And the one thing about Iran is that it is learning from North Korea. I mean, Iran is so defiant today because they saw that the North Korea did the same things a few years ago and has gotten away with it. I mean, Iran right now is a militant state like North Korea, and perhaps even a bit more dangerous in the sense that some of their senior leaders have these millennial views of history. And so, you know, it makes the Iranian president, Ahmadinejad, a particularly dangerous fellow to deal with. Iran, in a sense, isn't going to give up its weapon unless the United States has more effective diplomacy. And in this case, it's Russia and China which are supporting the Iranians, and we have to find some way to peel away either Russia or China from its support of Tehran. And I believe that Russia is the easier country to deal with in terms of trying to get them on board in coming to a constructive solution with regard to Iran.
Well, do Russia and China perhaps see these various states as a counterbalance to the United States? Because they can't be very happy with the current doctrines of the United States.
Well, Russia in particular was upset about the cancellation of the anti-ballistic missile treaty early in the Bush administration. Though the United States doesn't pose a nuclear threat to either Russia or China, both of them are trying to develop a world system in which America is not so powerful. So what they are trying to do, in effect, is to reduce the United States' influence in the world. And they have been successful at it, and we've been sort of helping them in that regard, which is really unfortunate. And so I think the United States really needs to develop policies that are more consistent and popular with the rest of the world. And in that way, I think that we would have much more success in dealing with not only with North Korea, but with Iran and the other countries that want the bomb.
I'm very much inclined to agree with your analysis, and thank you very much for coming on the program.
Thanks for the call. Let me take a step back for a moment, because earlier, a little bit earlier, you outlined the potential kind of pitch that the United States could make to the governor of North Korea in an effort to persuade the North Koreans to abandon their nuclear program. And that would be something like, look, we the United States will provide a range of incentives and assistance to you, North Korea. We'll see what we can do to help you with your energy problems. If you decide you want to develop nuclear power generation for peaceful means, we'll see what we can do about that. We'll see what we can do in a variety of ways. And also we can perhaps cool down the rhetoric between the two countries and perhaps make the first tentative steps toward bringing North Korea into the international community. It seems to me that the Clinton administration tried that. That was exactly the offer they made to North Korea, and they ran into a couple of problems. One being a Republican-controlled Congress that didn't want to do it. But the other was that it seemed that the North Koreans also we found out later that the North Koreans seemed like they didn't really have any intention of abandoning their nuclear program.
Well, they would want to keep their nukes if they could get away with it, and that's certainly. I think that if we look back at Clinton policy, there are really two criticisms of it. First of all, the agreement that the Clinton administration negotiated with North Korea was not as tough as it could have been. And also, the last-minute initiative to try to get North Korea to the table really occurred much too late. It should have been started earlier. Now, there are reasons why, and you point out, for instance, that the Republican takeover of Congress in 1994 really tied the hands of the Clinton administration, and also, of course, it was diverted because of the Monica Lewinsky scandal. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, the Clinton approach could have worked. North Korea is not going to want to easily give up its nuclear weapons, but the United States has to create conditions under which it has no choice but to agree. They're going to want to keep their nukes. They're going to want to keep their strong military. We just have to create a condition under which it's impossible for them to do so. And to do that, we need to be a little bit more clever than we have been. And the failure with regard to North Korea, therefore, is not a Republican failure, and it's not a Democratic failure. The failure has been bipartisan, and it's existed over decades.
Well, let me try one more scenario that I know it's something that you address in your book, and that you and other people feel that sooner or later the North Korean regime will collapse, and it will collapse because of growing demands for reform and greater freedom from the people of North Korea. So some people would say that's going to happen. And so in the meantime, if the North Korean government has some number of nuclear weapons, then we might just have to live with it and say, all right, there's nothing short of you using military force in the way that we would not want to do it that we can do to prevent them. So as long as we keep them contained and wait that history is on our side, eventually the government will change, and then we would have a new government, a different kind of government that would be willing to say, well, whatever weapons we have now, at this point we don't need them, we're going to get rid of them, we're going to dismantle our program, and that will be the ultimate solution to our problem.
Well, if North Korea were the only nuclearizing regime, that's a real possibility. But the reasons why we have problems in Iran today is because North Korea is not just about Korea. The Iranians saw that Kim Jong-il defied the international community. He withdrew from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. He kicked out the inspectors. And so the Iranians think that they can do the same thing. So in a large measure, whether Iran succeeds in nuclearizing will depend upon how we deal with North Korea. So this is a demonstration effect. And it's not just North Korea and Iran. There are a number of other countries that are thinking of nuclearizing themselves, including the possibility of Brazil in our own hemisphere. So we're talking not just about one or two countries. We're talking perhaps a dozen of them. And it's not, you know, it's one issue that they're hostile to us. It's another thing that some of these countries are unstable. And you just cannot contain an unstable regime. When you think about the problems with our border, I mean, if we're going to contain North Korea, we've got to make sure that no one can sneak in a disassembled nuke, a softball of uranium, or an orange of plutonium, and we have to be able to do that over the course of decades. You know, we can catch a shipment every now and then, but all it takes is just one failure to change the course of history. So I don't think that we can contain North Korea.
Let's try to get one more caller here. Savoy, line two. Hello.
Yeah, hi, how you doing? Mm-hmm. You know, if you look back in history, you know, just in recent history, you know, two of the greatest sneak attacks in history were, of course, Pearl Harbor, and the United States was negotiating that right up until the moment of the attack. And then to put things in real perspective and to kind of give you a feel for what you really could be dealing with is Operation Barbarossa. Whenever Hitler attacked Uncle Joe. Now, I'll tell you what, this is what you're dealing with. And you have to keep those Minuteman missiles spun up and on a moment's notice, or they'll try it.
Well, yeah, I agree that we need, at least at this point in our history, a nuclear deterrent. But we don't need 10,000 warheads to deter an adversary. We probably need only around 50 to be able to do that. Right now, North Korea is deterring the world with perhaps 10 nuclear weapons and without an absolutely proven nuclear capability. So it shows that in today's world, you don't need very many nukes to accomplish your purposes of deterrence. And right now, the United States can destroy human life several times over on this planet, and we're not going to be any less safe if we reduce our arsenal so that President Bush can give the order to kill everybody just once. So I think that we have a lot of room to reduce our own arsenal.
We're just about the point where we're going to have to finish. Are you at all optimistic that there is going to be any progress on this anytime soon?
I'd like to be optimistic. Unfortunately, I think that right now there are just too many problems in the world, and we're not employing the right approaches. So I'm very concerned, which is the reason why I wrote the book.
Then the book, if you want to read it, is Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, published by Random House, by our guest Gordon Chang. He's also author of the 2001 book, The Coming Collapse of China. You might want to look at that. I'm sure both are available in the bookstore or the library. Gordon Chang lived and worked in China and Hong Kong for almost 20 years, and he's written, in addition to writing these books, he's written for New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Far Eastern Economic Review, and the South China Morning Post. And Mr. Chang, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, too.